Just a heads up, this episode uses explicit language and deals with racialized violence. You're listening to First Words, a podcast where creativity, career, and kids collide. We're your hosts, Jasmine Aluma.
And I'm Casey Gates Fry.
Our guest today is Cassandra Lane, author of the memoir We Are Bridges, which was published in 2021 by the Feminist Press and winner of the Louise Merriweather First Book Prize. Her memoir is a poignant exploration of memory, which moves between 20th century rural South and present day Los Angeles, as she reimagines the intimate life of her great-grandparents. Her great-grandfather was lynched in 1904 at the hands of white men in his southern Mississippi town.
Before she moved to Los Angeles, she was a full-time journalist in New Orleans. She now splits her time writing, teaching, acting as editor-in-chief for LA Parent magazine, and being a mother to her 15-year-old son. So, Cassandra, when you were younger, you had decided that you did not want to become a mother. And I'm curious about that decision at that point in your life and what shifted for you.
Yes, absolutely. So I'm the oldest of five, of six, really, because my dad has a son that I didn't grow up with, but just in the same household, five of us being the oldest, you know, having a lot of duties, growing up poor, seeing my mother struggling. I loved kids, but I just felt like I've already kind of done this as a second mama. And I had another vision for myself that I thought shouldn't include kids, because I associated growing up, you know, struggle and poverty with child rearing for some reason in my young head. And so I wanted freedom. I wanted a sense of liberation. I wanted to travel. I wanted to work as a writer and live in New York or Paris. And so I made that decision. I had an abortion at 17. My mother was pregnant at the time. She had no idea what I was going through. And she had her fifth child. And just the heartbreak, seeing her go through the heartbreak with her male friends, I didn't want that. And I made a decision at 17 that I would not become a mother. The mask of gas the abortion doctor gave me filled me with hollows of laughter. I laughed and laughed and laughed. My bellows rang through the halls, creeping up Dos Reese's spine. There were pricks along my own spine. Deep tickles circled in my throat and settled in my belly. If there were a reactionary cringing in my uterus, if life tried to hang on to life, I do not recall. I was disconnected from it. I had programmed my brain for this mission. I had made a mistake. We had made a mistake, I told myself, and we just had to fix it. And I stuck with that decision until I became a mother in my mid 30s. So I loved my life in my 20s and early 30s, the life that I was able to craft as a journalist, as a writer, going to college and then working for about 10 years in the newsroom. And then just my friend groups, all of the travel that I was able to do. And then I moved here from New Orleans in 2001. I started the program at Antioch University, the MFA program. I had married a man who also did not want children, my first husband. And he was 13 years my senior and never changed his mind. But there was something about, I started teaching after I graduated from the program at Antioch. And again, I loved kids. I did love kids. I thought my way of giving back would be to help other people with their kids. But there was something very, very maternal that got triggered, I think, while I was teaching English and journalism to kids who were actually on probation or had been on probation at an alternative school in Highland Park. And they clung to me. I clung to them. We, you know, read Julius Caesar and Macbeth and dissected music and things that they at first kind of shirked, but then over time became really open to, for instance, studying Julius Caesar, because some of them who had been gang affiliated were able to relate, you know, what was going on in that play with their lives. It's like, literature is so powerful. I went to their games. At one point, I started going to some of their counseling sessions. And again, trauma, you know, yes, these kids had, some of them perpetrated crimes, some very petty, some more serious. But also when you hear their story, when I heard their stories and what they had gone through, whether it was neglect and abandonment, abuse, you know, being abused themselves. And something in me just, I wanted to write something, I think, not that I necessarily could right anybody's wrongs, but I wanted to, you know, not only help my students, but see if I could start from scratch with a child, with my own child. And I had some dreams about this same little girl. And I remember talking to my husband at the time about these dreams and journaling. I was doing a lot of work and therapy on myself and started understanding that I had made that decision out of a lot of resentment and fear and anger because of all of the things that I saw growing up and what my family went through. And I just had gotten to a point in my life that I didn't want my future to be determined by, you know, resentment and anger. But my ex-husband, and we're still really good friends, he said after we broke up, you were always, you know, bringing in the neighborhood kids at our house in New Orleans. I nailed up a chalkboard on the porch, and this, especially this one family, would come by every day, and we created little plays, did international food festivals, wrote. It was just really, it gave me so much fulfillment. And he saw that maternal side of me. And he said he always thought deep down that I would make a great mother. And I did after, you know, a couple of years after we broke up. So I just think that all of that played a role in me changing my mind, doing the therapy, doing the self-work, journaling, living, having time to live my life too. My mother got married at 16, had me at 17. And that's one of the things, you know, I heard and still hear about her regrets. I was in Paris in February and she told me that she always dreamed of going to Paris. Now her health is really bad. She doesn't think that's ever going to happen for her. So I don't, you know, by the time I reached my early to mid 30s, I didn't feel like life had been stolen from me. And so I just became open to sharing all of the gifts and bounties that I'd been given with a child of my own.
So 20 years ago in 2002, you began formulating and planting the seeds of what would become your memoir. 5 years after that, you gave birth to your son. So I'm curious, how did becoming a mother impact the evolution of your book, We Are Bridges?
Yeah, great question. It totally changed it. Because when I wrote those first seeds, as you say, I was a student at Antioch working on the MFA, and I was really just obsessed with the story of my great-grandfather who was lynched. And I wanted to examine how that domestic violence had trickled down through the generations. And so really, I didn't know if it was just, I was going to write it just as fiction. And at some point, because there were no records, there were no more living ancestors who could tell me what happened, you know, what exactly happened to Bert. We just had those little broken off bones, his first name, his last name, the fact that he had been lynched. My great grandmother, Mary, whom I remember very well, would say that he was just a beautiful, proud man. And the white people in that little Mississippi town didn't like that he was proud and he didn't cow down. So I just started trying to put flesh and bone on him to humanize him and their love, because even in her 90s, you know, she brought up Bert and her love for him and she cried. And I think also I was projecting my own, you know, marital challenges, questions, searching in my family and my bloodline for any semblance of a healthy relationship and couldn't find it. And so this ghost family, this ghost couple, became this jewel that I could hold up. But before, you know, appreciating the love that they had, I had to face the tragedy as well. And at some, I would get blocked because every time I, you know, turned one corner, it was still death. You know, I resurrected him, I like to say, from the dead, but had to lynch him and kill him all over again. And I didn't want, you know, as I was doing my own healing, didn't want a story that was just about death and trauma and loss. Did the men know that whenever Bert had time, he planted flowers just to make Mary happy? Did they know he caught butterflies just to sense the joy in their quivering wings as he let them go? The men would not have cared about any of these small beauties about Bert. Watching him get joy out of something so simple would have broken open their simmering fury. The nigger had the nerve to own a store and think he was better than them. Who the hell did he think he was? Not their equal, not white, not sacred, not even human. To silence the questions darting in her mind, Mary settles on this. As proud and as daring as he was, Bert did not have any last words. His cries, poetic and pleading, would have multiplied the stones in the men's hearts, shattering any sliver of mercy they may have fought for a blink to conjure. They were one heavy rope of no mercy. Mary is crying, but the tears rain down on the inside of her where no one can see. She unfastens the front of her dress and picks up her baby to nurse him. It was also an exercise in, you know, self-discovery, my own father abandonment, and it turned once I turned to the women in the family of survivors. And I realized too, as I started kind of accepting that I might be open to becoming a mother, that I had kind of pushed the women to the side, maybe taken them for granted in some way. They had led these domestic lives. It's just not the life that I wanted. And as I started turning to them as, you know, characters on the page, I just developed such a deeper appreciation for their strength and their survival and their creativity, their depth. So the book definitely took a turn in terms of its structure, in terms of the new pieces that I wrote and how I started at that point, I think, inserting my own story a little bit more.
And today your son has turned 15, and I'm curious, how much of your family history does your son know, and when will you feel comfortable with him reading your memoir, if ever?
Yeah, so he has a copy.
Great.
He used to be a huge reader when he was younger, and I would say all the way to fifth grade, which is when he got his first cell phone. So yeah, there you have it. He said he's read some pages. He's listened to some on Audible. I'm open, you know, to him reading it. I thought maybe 16 was the magical year that he could read it and we could talk about some of the complicated themes in the book and about my complicated life. But he was 13 when it came out, I believe, and my husband had picked him up from school one day, and there was an NPR article on the book, and my husband hadn't had a chance to read the article, but he was so excited. He picked up my son and said, you know, read this. Your mom's book is in here. And my son read it on the way home from school. And the article was pretty long and went into depth on what some of the more spicier, as my son likes to say, parts of the book are. And these were all revelations to my son, that I had had an affair, that I had had an abortion. These are things that we hadn't talked about, not because I was, you know, trying to hide them. I just thought, you know, age appropriate, maybe around 15, 16. So that article was, you know, kind of outed me, and he got home and he was like, "Mom, I didn't know that happened. I didn't know you did that." And so I was like, well, I guess, you know, I never needed for you to think that I was a saint, and it's not that I was trying to hide it. It's just that these are things I was going to talk to you about later. And I guess we can start those conversations now. So we have a very close and open relationship. I don't want to pressure him to read it fully until he's ready, but he knows that, you know, when he does, we can talk about it, not only my story, but about our ancestors. He knows, you know, what happened to Burt Bridges. He definitely knows that his great-great-grandfather was lynched, and that, you know, his great-great-grandmother is someone that I remember very well. And I talk about her tea cakes recipe that we never got. So he definitely knows, you know, some of the story. He's very interested in Louisiana and culture and the food. So I think that's something that we'll continue to develop as he gets older.
That's great. And I love that story about him reading the article. I've found just with family members in general, especially if they're children or maybe not artistic themselves, sometimes it's hard because they're so close to us for them to understand what we do or what we're doing. You know, we're just in a room with the door closed. And when they get to see someone outside and their perspective on that person that's close to them, it's almost like it clicks more, you know?
Yes, he definitely, I would say, is one of my biggest cheerleaders. He, even this today, you know, I told him, I was like, I know I wasn't able to go to the movies with you and Dad last night. Every weekend I've had, you know, events, et cetera. And I just wanted to know how you're feeling about that. Like, how would you describe Mom's, you know, work schedule? And he was like, I see you as really hardworking. You don't slack. And I'm just proud of you. And I was like, oh my God. Like, I don't want, you know, but I still want to find that balance. And I told him, this is not always how it's going to be. I'm juggling like three different things, full-time work still. But it's great to see him, you know, understand, especially at this age. And he's an artist himself. He loves to create, whether it's music, drawing, you know, videos. So I think that he'll get into a zone. So I'm glad to kind of model that practice for him.
I love how you phrase that question too. Just like, what do you think? What are your thoughts on my schedule? And I'm going to tuck that away.
Yeah, exactly.
When you did the research for this book, a lot of it was listening to your mother talk and researching the women in your life and your ancestors. And so I'm wondering, what are the greatest lessons you learned from the women in your life? I know your perspective on them changed in the writing.
I think with my grandmother, she was a domestic. And yet she, you know, she didn't come, by the time I was born, she was already retired from her job as a maid. But she, even when she was working, she always had her side projects, you know, quilting was her thing, cooking. And I just remember her getting up at 3, hearing her at 3:30 in the morning, shuffling across the old wooden floors, doing her thing. That was her time to create, her time to not have to worry about what her adult children needed, her grandchildren, because we lived with them after my mom's divorce, what we needed, what her husband needed, who once he retired, he was very needy. And so I think what I learned from her and from my mom, who is a very gifted gospel guitarist, really a lot of the lessons that I took once I started writing more about them was applicable to my own creative practice. You know, just, I get up, I'm a morning person as well. I try to get up at 4:30 to have my own, to carve out my own time before the rest of the house gets up. Also accepting that this is a lifelong practice. You know, my grandmother was in her 80s when she died. My mother has, I don't know, 7 guitars in her little music room. Even with her health problems, you know, she's in there, she's not performing publicly right now because of her health problems, but just from them, I saw that part of them outside of them being my, you know, mother and grandmother, that these were women who had something to say in their own way.
In her memoir, we learn Cassandra's great-grandfather was lynched in 1904. At the time, his young wife, Mary Magdalene McGee, was pregnant with Cassandra's grandfather. One of the most significant moments in the book for me is when Cassandra learns that she herself will give birth to a boy, when she had assumed she would have a daughter. Suddenly, she has to sit with the weight of what it means to raise a Black man in our country, while simultaneously uncovering the details of Bert's death. Thinking of these truths made me curious about where she's at now in relation to her ancestors after having published the book.
If you could go back, what would you ask your great-grandmother, Mary Magdalene McGee?
Oh my God, so much. I want to know what she looked like when she was younger. Do we have one photo of her when she's already in her 90s, which the one that I describe in the book? I have no idea, you know, what she looked like. She said that Bert was handsome, but, you know, what did he look like specifically? Who taught her how to make those tea cakes? You know, was that kind of just something that she came up with? Was it a mother? Was it an aunt or a neighbor? Definitely for the recipe for the tea cakes, she had told my mother that she was going to teach her how to make them. And then the next day, actually, she fell and broke her hip and went into the nursing home and didn't come home. She ended up passing. So we never had that tea cake recipe. It's something that haunts me, and not only me, but my sister, Lydia, my mother. My mother has her old clay bowl that she used to make the tea cakes in, and I attempted for the first time to try to make a batch when I was visiting my mom in January, but nothing is close to that. So I want to know, you know, I want to know so much. You said one thing, but I guess I would have so many questions.
And if you could say anything to Bert Bridges, what would you tell him?
That we're so proud of him, that he was strong, that we're encouraged by his strength. We're encouraged by the fact that he did hold his head high. Yes, I'm just so proud of him, and I hope that he's proud of the work that I'm doing.
Writing about racism and trauma is difficult, to say the least. And you're an early morning writer. So I'm curious about that transition from working early in the morning, like your grandmother did, and then transitioning to being a mother, and taking care of a little one and taking your kid to school. What is your self-care like? How do you balance the two?
Yeah, that's great. And it's so important. And I try to share that with writers whenever I'm doing a workshop or just talking to friends. So first, for my writing experience, I'm in my studio. So I feel lucky and blessed and fortunate to have a space that I've been able to carve out for myself. I haven't always, you know, had that. So for me, just first making my writing space beautiful, making it warm, lighting candles and incense and having my space heater on early in the mornings when it's still kind of cool, it just kind of creates this warm, safe, womb-like space for me. And so I do feel very cared for and loved because of the environment that I create for myself. And also because I'm creating this space for me. It's still dark, it's quiet, the neighborhood is quiet, and it feels like my own special thing. And in addition to that, therapy, I believe in therapy. And, you know, now, which we always had these tools, but you don't necessarily have to be in person. You're having a down moment, you can jump on a Zoom with your therapist. having just a few close friends. I have one friend who's an amazing writer, and we can't spend hours and hours on the phone, but what we've gotten to the practice of doing is just recording little voice memos to each other. And they're really to ourselves, you know, hearing ourselves kind of work out a puzzle. But, you know, this, we know, I know my sister is on the other end, she's going to listen to it, maybe not right away, but when she can, and then she responds. And we've just had, so this has been going on now for about a year. And so many things have opened up for us, you know, not only in our writing, but in our psychology and things that we need to kind of take care of. And honesty too, like hearing each other echo these different questions and concerns. And then I just love fun. I love exploring wherever it is, my own city, traveling, you know, going out to eat. I love food. So just hanging out with friends and laughing, hanging out with my son, I've taken so many walks. I know so many of us have, especially during this pandemic. So really every day doing some sort of a photo walk. Even if I don't get to hiking, we have so many great hiking areas in LA, but just my neighborhood, I've gotten to know my neighborhood in such a deeper way. Over these last 2 years, and have photographed especially one tree probably 40 times in different light and different days. And that's just, I don't know what's going to happen to any of that, but it's just a way for me to spend time with myself and in nature. Mm-hmm. I have dolls that I play with and dress and just anything that makes me feel like laugh or feel a sense of joy helps me balance out writing about heavier things.
Yeah. That's grounding.
To Solomon, December 28th, 2006. It may be a boy, Dr. Dwight said. I left his office, went to the restroom, and had a breakdown. What will I do with a boy, I thought. What will Marcus do with a third boy? He was sad too, but we are better now. January 12th, 2007. Happy New Year. This is the first year that I will give birth, a literal birth. January 20th, 2007. Dear Solomon, I cannot wait for you to get here. Cannot wait to hold you in my arms, to kiss your cheeks, your lips. It is true. I had dreamed of having a little girl. I had felt the ache of desire in my heart for her, her hair, her precious little fashions. Carmen was to be her name. Yet I should have known you were inside me. Twice you visited me in my dreams, pleading with your eyes and anxious smile for me to accept you.
So you are the managing editor-in-chief of LA Parent magazine. So as a parent who is also a full-time working mom, what does your writing life look like and how do you make it work?
I'm like laughing hysterically.
I feel like that laugh just says it all. There's right. The answer. That's it right there.
Exactly. That says a lot. Sometimes I don't know. I mean, last year, I don't really know how I balanced because I was managing editor and I got promoted to editor in chief just a couple of months before the book came out. So I feel like I was sleepwalking through it. I know that it was amazing. I did a ton of podcasts and interviews and readings while also having more responsibility as editor in chief. And having a smaller staff because of the pandemic, some cuts were made. You know, it was a real balancing act. I know one of the things that was lost is that all of last year I really didn't write. I'm a journal person, so I would jot down just a sentence or two or paragraph here or there. But I really, that's one thing that I definitely was not able to do last year. I'm just now this year finding my groove again and trying to get back into, you know, getting up at 4 when the alarm goes off. Because there was a point where the alarm didn't have to go off. But this is before I was juggling so much. I think my body did crash over this last year. And it's like, no, I'm not getting up, but I'm trying now to get back into that groove. And my husband is very hands-on with our son. That's been helpful. If you're not partnered, you know, maybe there's a parent who lives nearby or a neighbor that you trust. For parents of younger kids, you know, a babysitter that you really trust. I know when my son was younger, I don't have family here in Louisiana. I'm in California. I'm from Louisiana, and there's no blood family here. But I was teaching when I met the parent of one of the, I would teach English during the day. And then in the evening while I was grading papers, the jazz band took over my classroom to practice. And which I didn't mind because they sounded amazing. And one of the moms was very protective of her son because these were high schoolers where her son was so talented. He was at the sister middle school that they pulled him out of the middle school band and were like, no, you're going to practice with the high schoolers. So she would sit there the whole time. She just wanted to keep an eye on her little middle school son practicing with these high schoolers. And she and I started talking, got close. I was pregnant at the time. And I don't know, there was just something very, she was from LA, but her mother was Southern, and there was just something Southern about her. And she knew a lot about the South because of her mother. And she ended up becoming my son's sort of play aunt. And she, you know, sure enough, after he was born, I think she started babysitting him around 3 months. He was 3 months old. Once I went back to work. I took off that summer and then went back to work in the fall. And we're still, she's still, you know, a family friend 15 years later. So just having someone that you, if you don't have family around, someone that you trust to help you, you know, and not feeling like you're being less of a dad or a mom because maybe you go away for a weekend. I have done that. I have done writing retreats. Both things that I applied to, as well as my as self-directed writing retreats. So I just think that's important to have, whether it's, you know, a partner who understands and supports you, a family member, or a family friend.
I think part of Jasmine and I creating this podcast is just wanting to hear so many different perspectives on how do you write and parent. And so hearing how you do that is super helpful. And I'm curious, if someone who is a writer is about to become a parent or considering it, what advice might you give them?
Ugh, read everything that Toni Morrison says about writing and mothering. and that really helps. My friend Tamika and I talk about that, the one who we send voice memos to each other. Because, you know, it's not in a vacuum. Women have been having babies forever, and women who are creative and women who write have as well. And so I really turned to Toni Morrison. Loved her sons, and of course mothering was super important for her, but we also know that she wrote these seminal works. There's a book about Toni Morrison. I can't remember the title, but it's really about her kind of placing motherhood as a political act. Andrea O'Reilly is the editor. And there's just so many powerful lines in there. My book is just lined up everywhere. Her talking about motherhood and seeing it as a place of power. So that really helped me, especially in those days where I was most frustrated. And, you know, I didn't want to give up mothering, but I also didn't want to give up my writing. Mm-hmm. So reading Morrison talking about, you know, flipping the switch, changing your words, your language around it, changing your perspective, and especially as a Black mother, and seeing Black motherhood, but I think for all mothers, but seeing Black motherhood in my case as a place of power, as a place of, you know, shaping the culture, of giving voice to my ancestors' unrealized dreams. It was so empowering to me. Just as Alice Walker's journals are, her latest journal, Blossoms Under Fire, she's very honest about her struggles as a mother and her ambivalent feelings at times, her feelings of resentment as a mother at times. And that too is so liberating. So you have this one saying, no, motherhood is the source of power. It's the best thing I ever did. And then this other giant saying, there are times where I don't like this person who is my child. I just think it's so freeing, and we're not alone. We never were. Just feel like over the last, I would say maybe 10 years that I've seen become conscious of, like, the sustainability grant for parents specifically. You know, they do have their annual grant, but they do other programming around it to support parents, I think, throughout the year. And then PEN Parentis is another organization for parent writers. And I just, here in the LA community, it's such a wonderful literary community that's very supportive. Several of us are parents, and we bring our kids. My son's been, that's who he knows, are writers, adult writers. So I just think that, you know, the community, and I'm sure in other cities as well, they're open now to people bringing their kids. You know, you could sit by the back door if your kid is still young and, you know, they might protest, you can easily slip out. I supported a friend who hadn't read her work publicly ever, maybe during her MFA program, of course, to graduate, but not since then. And she wanted to go to the AWP conference. This was in 2019. And she'd had a baby who was only a few months old, and she had a toddler, and she did not want to leave her baby at home. She just very attached parenting, but our panel had been accepted. And so those of us on the panel were like, we're going to rent an Airbnb. It was a beautiful home. Your baby is welcome. It's going to work. So we went, we did the panel. One of her friends who was in Chicago flew down because she's a writer too. So while we were on the panel, she was in the audience with the baby. Later, when this woman had to do her first reading since graduating from her MFA program, we were holding the baby. The baby started crying. She had her wrap on already just in case. And as the baby started crying, one of us walked the baby up to her. She put the baby in the wrap and kept reading. And everybody like applauded. So I just think, yeah, we have the power to take it back and still say, this is who I am. Mm-hmm. I deserve to be here. Mm-hmm. Part of who I am is also a mother, and my child deserves to be here if it's appropriate as well.
Yeah. And it doesn't make me any less of a writer, an artist. It doesn't take away. It just enhances it.
Yeah, because afterwards she was like, oh my, we took all the photos, and she was just putting up her arm like, I'm a superpower. And yeah. Of course, not in the sense that we don't want to be super women and say that we don't have weaknesses, because we do. That's also a danger. But a superpower in that moment, I did it. I worked it. It's not about it being perfect, but it is about, okay, what are the workarounds, and feeling empowered in that. So. Mm-hmm.
I love that story. That's a great example of, you know, motherhood doesn't stop, especially in those early times. And your art doesn't have to stop either, you know, and they can live together. That's that's so cool.
Yeah. And one of the things that I tell mothers too, and I was so glad, not that every mother is going to write about motherhood at all. But for me, because I was, part of it was about motherhood or becoming a mother, I, you know, encourage women to journal, like to journal throughout the pregnancy. I did that. And it really came in handy as we were in those last stages of revising. There were just things that I could not remember anymore. And luckily I was able to go back to my journals of 2006 when I was pregnant with him, 2007, and actually weaved in a few, not a lot, but a few of those direct passages, and was able to get back into my head. Yeah. When I was pregnant, and also when he was young. So yeah, don't stop. Even if you feel like, oh, I can't sit down an hour a day, you can journal here and there, even while you're breastfeeding or whatever, or bottle feeding, you can at least journal.
What were your son's first words?
Oh my God. I think it sounded more like Dada. I'd have to go back to my journal.
That's That's a good plug for that journaling.
Yes.
What was the first thing you said when you saw your son?
Oh my God, he's so alert, because he was. They put him belly to belly. And it's, I think he lifted his head. He looked, his eyes were so big, and he looked into my eyes, and he was so alert, like he had been here before. And then the next words were, oh my God, he's peeing on me, because I felt its warmth.
That's amazing. What are the first words of your current project?
Oh, I have it right here. In late 2007, our heads filled with scenes from HGTV, my husband and I became first-time house hunters in Los Angeles.
That's a story.
So this is word association. So I'm going to say one word and you tell me the first word that comes to your mind. Electric.
Lightning.
Generation.
Bird bridges.
Heat.
Passion.
Memory.
Faulty.
Dream.
Big.
Salt.
Tasty.
Legacy.
My son.
Amazing.
Thank you for listening to First Words Podcast. Join our community by following us on Instagram at firstwords.podcast and by joining our Facebook group called First Words, a podcast and community for writer parents. If you liked this episode, please consider leaving us a review. It helps more parents and writers find stories like this one.
First Words is recorded, edited, and co-produced by James Hilmer.